change photon into mass. How do you call that process?
I'm not quite sure what you're alluding to. I mean, theoretically, usually if you're going to have interactions of photons, you're going to tend to need some kind of non-energy interface. It'll have to hit a dust particle or something. And theoretically, you could have two photons collide in a proper environment and turn into a positron electron pair.
You hit it in the center, right? So it's a pair production. When the photon changes into electron and positron, the mass energy is conserved. That would happen when a gamma photon interacts with nucleus, in which it loses the energy. No. Technically, the power production, a pair production, is a mode of interaction of gamma rays with the matter. And during this process, they will result in loss of the energy. During a pair production, energy of the incident photon will get it converted into the matter. That would be, if I remember correctly, the 102 mega electron volts, that's the amount of energy that is released, that is needed for that process to take. Maybe you know better. Enter here.
No, you need to have conservation of a whole bunch of different things, including energy. So the energy of two photons colliding with each other has to come close to the amount of energy inherent in the pairs of electron-positron. You can make other matter-antimatter pairs with higher energy, but you have to conserve a whole bunch of different things. And one of the things that kind of confused the issue of whether or not a photon has truly nothing equivalent to mass is, how do photons then have something we call momentum? And they do have momentum because in order for these conversions to occur, you have to obey the conservation of momentum laws. That's why you can't have, you could make a photon as powerful as 10 gamma photons that can create matter-antimatter pairs, but they won't produce a pair because you don't have the right momentum after the reaction. So it would break the laws of conservation of momentum, which tends to be a quality of matter, not particularly energy, but, you know, who knows what the next theory about everything is going to tell us.
You said at the beginning, collision with photon with photon. Well, technically, photon cannot collide with another photon and a part of itself. Enter again.
I think I made a point of just about every time saying it has to be in the presence of a non-energy particle in order for the photons to change, to either, if you want to say, decay or undecay or what have you. But there has to be some non-energy medium involved in the interaction of the photons.
Yeah, that is correct. Let's say we have a photon interaction of nucleus. Now, the next thing is... So the pair production is one among those with which photon can interact with atoms and electrons in pair production. A photon creates electron and positron. But anyhow, the next one would be kind of tricky. True or false? I mean, it's easy, but it's not. True or false? Propagation speed increases as frequency increases. Again. Is it true or false? Propagation speed increases as frequency increases. Enter here.
again, what are we talking about? Are we talking about acoustic waves? Are we talking about electromagnetic waves?
Electromagnetic waves.
Okay. Electromagnetic waves travel at the speed of light in a vacuum. Even when they are apparently slowed down in a impedance material, glass, diamonds, what have you, that's an apparent delay, not a real delay, electromagnetic waves can only propagate at one speed, the speed of light, in a vacuum, which is unrelated to their frequency.
Yeah, but then I added the factor of frequency. Okay. So now, phase velocity defines the speed at which waves oscillating at a particular frequency propagate. And now, I have a table in front of me which says, if we have air, then we have at 1 hertz frequency 299.8 meters per microsecond. And at 1 kilohertz we have the same. And 1 megahertz we have the same. How about seawater? Do you think that holds for seawater despite its frequency? Interesting.
Okay, you are talking about phase velocity. Phase velocity does not carry any information. So the phase velocity of electromagnetic waves don't have any effect on the speed of transferring any information. Group velocity has an effect on information. So you would have to modify the group velocity. So that's unfortunately the difference between the concepts of phase velocity, which can be variable and can be faster than the speed of light, and group velocity, which is what actually carries any information, because ultimately the constant of the speed of light in the vacuum is not so much a velocity limitation as a causality or an information limiting concept, that no bit of knowledge can travel faster than the speed of light in a vacuum. So I will give you that the phase velocity of electromagnetic waves in certain mediums can be discerned to be faster than the speed of light, but ultimately that doesn't help anyone trying to get information any faster than the speed of light in a vacuum.
Thank you for that. So at seawater, at 1 hertz, we have a phase velocity of 0.17,000 of meter per microsecond. At 1 kilohertz, we have a 0.5500 meter per microsecond. And at 1 megahertz, we have 1.7 meter per microsecond. I was in geophysics for a number of years. So sedimentary sulfide and magnetite, they also have a different phase velocity based on the frequency. I wonder if you were aware of that. Interaction.
Well, like I just finished saying, phase velocity is not terribly useful, but interesting, and it can vary all over the place, and the phase velocity under certain circumstances can be faster than the theoretical maximum speed of light in a vacuum. But that's kind of meaningless. No one really cares about the phase velocity of anything because changing it doesn't do anything. It's changing the group velocity of electromagnetic waves that would have an effect on how long it took to get information. If you were into investment and you wanted to be able to have a couple of extra seconds on the value of stocks, bonds, commodities across, you know, on the other end of the world, arbitrage, and you could shave a couple of seconds off of it by increasing your group velocity transmission, you'd be a trillionaire. If you increase the phase velocity of your transmission, you wouldn't make a buck.
So the speed of light in a vacuum is about 1 foot per nanosecond. In the coaxial cable, it's about two-thirds of this. That would be 8 inches per nanosecond. So for 100 feet cable, the round trip time is about 300 nanoseconds, which is close to mirror time of 360 nanoseconds. What do you understand by round trip term? End to exchange.
Okay. Any material that effectively has an impedance to optical frequencies will offer a visual delay to the signal. You see that in the type of insulating central insulator of a coax cable, depending upon the material, it has a different impedance, and so it's very much like the impedance of optical crystals, like a diamond, which gives you what we call for diamonds an optical quality, optical density. Optical density is just an impedance measurement for optical electromagnetic waves. So they will produce a seeming decrease in the speed of the electromagnetic wave. Ultimately, once again, the electromagnetic wave is not really slowing down, because if it did slow down and then got to the edge of the transmission line, of the impedance, the diamond, the glass, or whatever, and then it sped up again, you'd have a problem explaining it due to conservation of energy. If an object is traveling slower and then faster, it has to gain energy if it's real speed.
It's 2:11. I want to wrap it up, so let me go further with that. In information for space report professional, he could say a few words about it. I was reading the article about caves on the moon that could be used around the year, where the temperature is about 16 degrees of Celsius constant. They are natural and they are deep. There is of course a speculation that it could be at their depth, they could be expanded left and right. So that would be, and the size of it is like the size of Los Angeles. It's a typical size of those. So that's for space report. WS2M.
Yes, Paul. Do you want to expound on Wesley's question about moon caves?
Lava tubes. When the moon was formed, you know, had this other planet, Mars-sized planet, Theos, hit the Earth, spun off, and now you wound up with this molten mass orbiting Earth, which eventually became the moon. And a lot of the, now that it was hot, a lot of it settled, and then that left voids, and very similar to lava tubes. In fact, you know, there was some, a lot of stuff pushed out of the moon. And then when it cooled, it flowed out, you wound up with these essentially caves, You know, and they're photographing them now with the what we have, the lunar reconnaissance orbiter going around the moon since 2009, taking pictures, and they found hundreds of these things that Wesley's talking about, and with even, you know, very clear pictures. And now we're going to eventually have, of course, more pictures on future satellites that are going to really show up. And temperature, well, he gave it in centigrade. I heard 65 degrees or something could be your average temperature inside these things. You could put towns inside, you know, and live there. That's the theory. Anyway, back to you, Roy.
Okay. Does that answer your question, Wes?
Yes, it is. 60 degrees of centigrade is like not so hot. It's like a very much comfortable temperature. Approximately 60 degrees of centigrade, of 60 degrees of Fahrenheit. Okay, I'm going. Thank you very much for the information. I'm going to the next one. In 1990, we were fairly certain about the expansion of universe. It might have enough of density to stop its expansion and recollapse, and it might have so little energy density that it would never stop expanding. But the gravity was certain to slow the expansion as the time went on. So we're talking about a slowing universe. But, of course, in 1998, we have a Hubble Space Telescope, and actually we found that it's quite reverse. What is the cause of it? How do you call that phenomenon? And to Xia.
Well, in the good old days, I think that they had already kind of come up with the Big Bang Theory, although it was, the name for it was a derisive name. It was meant to embarrass the people who had come up with it. And there was this very nice, and it was a very, to me, eloquent description where the universe expanded after the Big Bang, but gravity slowly slowed down the rate of expansion. And ultimately, at one point, it stopped expanding. And the same gravitational force then caused it to collapse in on itself, which would cause it to become a singularity at one point or another, which would become unstable and explode into another Big Bang and another universe. And so you would have, it would never need a beginning. It would never need an end. It was just a bang, boom, bang, boom, bang, boom. And then there were interesting people who wrote science fiction stories on how each Big Bang caused the same universe. So although we all unfortunately know that we're going to die someday, there was a possibility in those science fiction works to be reborn in the next Big Bang and the one after that and the one after that. Made for some very interesting science fiction. Let me drop for a second. Unfortunately, the science doesn't rest on quaint, eloquent ideas. So they actually measured the Hubble constant, and they found that, unfortunately, rather than slowing down the way it's supposed to, in their mind, the speed of the universe was expanding at an increased rate. So ultimately, what that means is there's not enough mass in the universe to slow it down. It's a runaway train.
What is that is actually causing the two terms, they're blamed for speeding up expansion of the universe. How does he call it?
It is dark energy. As the universe increases in size, probably the more accurate term in the English language would be that the scale function of the universe increases because planets don't increase in size, just the distance between objects that aren't tightly held together by mutual gravitational fields spread out. Space itself spreads out, and space has an inherent amount of energy. So that's a violation of conservation of energy, unfortunately, but that seems to be what's going on. As space-time expands with the universe, so does vacuum energy expand. And the vacuum energy is believed to be the propulsion that's driving everything even farther apart.
How would you describe dark matter and dark energy and the difference between them?
Okay. Theoretically, dark matter, again, probably is not well chosen in terms of what it is. It's not that it's dark, it's that it's kind of invisible, that it does not interact with light in any way, electromagnetic waves. So you don't see them. They do interact with gravity and mass, and so they do curve space-time. And what has drawn people's attention to dark matter is there were studies that tried to explain how galaxies work. And they calculated the amount of visible matter in a given galaxy, and it made no sense. The shape that it was in, it would have been twisted and torn apart rather quickly unless they got the matter wrong. So they improvised and interpreted that there's a shroud of matter of some quality that can't be detected by electromagnetic waves. So that's dark matter. Now, it might turn out that there's no such thing as dark matter. There have been lots of particles, theoretical particles, that have been brought up as possibly being this dark matter. There's a whole class of theoretical particles that have not been proven in numerous attempts at CERN, but they're still looking for those particles, but it might not be particles. It might be that gravity works a little bit different than we understand it in large areas. And so Paul mentioned it a few times in the SpaceNet report. It's called MOND, M-O-N-D. You can Google it. It's an interesting theory of how gravity might be a little bit different than we perceive it. So that's dark matter. Let me drop. Dark energy is just purely non-matter. It's non-mass. It's energy. So it's the vacuum energy of space-time. And as the volume of space in our universe increases, the amount of vacuum energy increases along with it. Yes, Paul.
Yeah, just back up a step. The person that came up with the idea that led to the idea of dark matter was Vera Rubin. She worked. She was one of these people staring at plates. You know, they didn't have charge couple devices taking pictures of. You know, they had, actually had plates of different areas of the sky, and she figured out that the stars, like you said before, were not moving properly, you know, in the outer areas of a galaxy compared to the inner areas, and that's what led to that. And then they said the only thing that could be doing that is gravity is changing in those areas. And let's call whatever is making that gravity change dark matter. But Vera Rubin, I got the credit for that. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, good. Thank you, Paul. Yeah, people should get respect for their discoveries. Unfortunately, we've forgotten a lot of names. Some of them get put on units of measure, and so we know them vaguely from that. But there's a lot of people who spent a lot of hard work. And analyzing those plates, you have to be obsessive compulsive. I would have gone crazy after probably the second plate, that seemed to be something that they very often gave women as a job. Kind of fortuitous in some ways, unfortunate in others, but yeah, it seems that gravity might not work quite the way we know it to. Another theory was that there were microscopic black holes going on causing this. I think that's kind of not been that important to theory. So it's you either believe in supersymmetry particles or other esoteric particles, or you believe in some variation of a slightly different way that gravity interacts in our universe.
Well, I have a problem with distribution. So it's uniformity and density. It sounds to be uniform. It's not supposed to be for the matter uniform. If it's uniform, then that would be nonsense either, which is a nonsense. Doesn't exist. But dark matter is not antimatter. And if we could detect baryonic clouds and their absorption or radiation passing through them, we cannot do it with dark matter, ladies and gentlemen. And so the dark matter is not antimatter. Antimatter. Because we cannot see the unique gamma rays that are produced when antimatter annihilate with matter. So the first would actually in my brain is kind of protesting in uniformity. We have matter, then we have density of the matter, which is not uniform. What do you think about that? And to explain.
Okay, you brought up a bunch of different things. Antimatter is not that much different than matter. It simply has opposite charges and such. But it interacts with electromagnetism just as much as matter does. So you would see clouds or clusters or big bodies of antimatter. It wouldn't be invisible to electromagnetic waves. So unless you want to rewrite how gravity works and say that there's a particle, it has to be a particle that doesn't interact with electromagnetic waves, and that's not what antimatter is. So you could push antimatter off to the side. Density, globally, according to the microwave cosmic background, the universe is highly homogeneous, but not completely. There are very, 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 very slight quantum fluctuations in the background cosmic rays and in the distribution of gas molecules and such, and that gravity kind of pulled local clusters of them together to build planets and stars and solar systems and galaxy and galactic clusters and other such things.
Okay, so we can rule out the large galaxy size black holes. Or how about gravitational lensing? Matter should be observable, any matter, in around those areas, right or wrong. Maybe our space professional has something to say about it.
Well, I'll certainly give Paul an opportunity, but the problem that you have is the density of mass. In black holes, you have a very dense collection of mass, so you have a much more obvious case of optical gravitational lensing. So So light going through, pass to the sides of them, get refracted off of them. When you have a diffuse collection of invisible matter, it's much more difficult to discern any significant distortions due to gravitational lensing. The more dense and single the mass is, the more it will visibly distort around itself. The more diffuse it is, the less.
KG2RY.
Yes, David.
You know, we've talked about this before. The concept of form or matter being mostly empty space.
Okay, that's something that we've talked about before and probably talk about in the future, that most of everything is empty space. That unfortunately school books that draw an atom don't really draw you an accurate one to scale because it would make no particular sense. If you put the nucleus in the middle as a single period, you would have to have the electron cloud somewhere over in New Jersey. So, yeah, a lot of what we think of solid matter is mostly made out of empty space.
Okay. Another question. It's actually refreshment. We mentioned it before. Astronomers, they call everything that is heavier than helium, they call it metals. Why is that? Maybe Paul has something to say?
Well, that was actually a puzzle question a couple of weeks ago. And the best of my understanding is simply it was easier for them to do it that way, that originally a lot of their spectrographic studies ended up being metals, because most of the elements on the periodic table are metals. There's only, I think, about maybe 17 or 16 non-metal elements. And it just got easier. You know, they were discussing actual metals. So as they detected nonmetals, they just included it along on the list, and they, for their specialty, redefined metal as any element that is not hydrogen and helium. Now, even though hydrogen and helium are designated not a metal by chemists and by astronomers, there are some conditions where you can produce hydrogen metal. If you make it cold enough and increase the local pressure high enough, it will develop metallic qualities like mercury. So it is possible to force hydrogen into a metallic form. Nevertheless, in astronomy, if you're not hydrogen and you're not helium, they tell you that you're a metal.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, the hydrogen they believe in the inside Jupiter. It's so dense inside that any of the hydrogen, you know, a lot of it has gotten so compressed that it's actually turned into a liquid, essentially a liquid metal. Like the next step would actually be metal, but it's so dense. You know, that when it's turning, you know, you get the dynamo effect, similar to what we have on Earth, except that instead of magma, it's liquid hydrogen. And because it's acting as a metal, it's creating a tremendous magnetic field. And that's why Jupiter has the biggest magnetic field out of all the planets. I mean, it goes out as far as the orbit of Saturn, they say. I mean, the field just extends millions and millions of miles because of this liquid hydrogen. almost in a metallic form. Back to you, Ryan.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And laboratories on Earth have been able to produce for small periods of time metallic hydrogen. So it's a combination. It requires a great deal of pressure, but gravity can produce all kinds of things, much more powerful than even turning hydrogen into metals. The gravity of a pre-neutron star is enough to violate certain degeneracy laws, that you can't press electrons and protons together and create neutrons. So you end up with a cloud of neutrons where there used to be electrons and protons and some neutrons. So pressure, gravity, although the weakest force in nature, has no range, so you can keep on piling more and more of it in an area until you've collapsed space-time around it and created black holes.
Okay. I found a little bit less complicated explanation. I'm going to read it. Quote, astronomers lazily refer to anything heavier than helium as metals, and there is a little motivation to change this nomenclature, since there is an orders of magnitude gap between the abundance of helium and the abundance of carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, etc. in the universe. So it's rather historically determined. That's what I read. Dr. Roy.
Okay, but, you know, I could use the same rationalization to call everything heavier than helium marshmallows. Right? I mean, all the criteria is still met.
Absolutely. I agree.
And it would be funny as hell to read their research papers.
Okay. I think I occupied the repeater for a long time, and probably there are a few people who wants to ask the real questions of real nature for real ham radio amateurs. And I do thank you very much, Dr. Roy, for giving me a chance for the science section. And to Xia.
You're welcome, Wesley, and I hope we do have a few questions out there, people sitting around thinking about stuff. So once again, I am AC2GS, and my name is Roy, and this is the Limark Technical Net. And the grist for the mill is the questions or comments or topics of interest. So if you're out there and you have something for us, please hit that push-to-talk button.
KG2RY.
Yes, David.
I want to thank Wesley for making the recommendation of Da Vinci Studio Resolve, that I bought the full version, and I'm having a really great time figuring out all the effects. The effects don't come with the free version. Go ahead.
Yeah, there are modules that are not included in the free version. So I'm glad you thought it was worth your while, and it's a steep climb. It's not an obvious user interface. So I wish you luck, and if Wesley has any words of wisdom, feel free to add them.
And it does have everything, including graphics and 3D. Let me drop.
You guys doubled, but Wesley won. WS2N.
Well, he's closer to the repeater.
Thank you. I'm sorry. So thank you. So thank you very much for the compliment. Now, the good thing about it is all of the upgrades are free for the free version and all of the upgrades for the paid version. If you compare it to any other software, which would be Premiere Adobe Premiere, you can leave in 1 month more money to pay four of the modules, and you're going to have more problems with it than you're going to be paying for the paid version of DaVinci Resolve Studio. It's a great tool. Now, there is another one that I was playing with, and it's called Blender. And Dr. Roy was mentioning Blender also, so maybe he could say a few words about it. Thank you.
Yeah, well, but it's a different technology. Blender is a 3D modeler. Now, my understanding is a new version came out. I think it was 4.5. I could have my version numbers completely wrong. But it's a different type of device. If you are interested in rendering 3D objects, Blender is a very cost-effective piece of software and has a lot of advanced features.
Yes, I was playing with Blender for many years, and it's free. You don't have to pay for it. It's great for 3D graphics, and you can create it. So amazingly. DaVinci Resolve has its own module that could actually make up 3D. So it has many modules. And all of it is for free if you want to have to play with the free version and to actually.
Yeah, I got to say, I'm not so interested in 3D. I think everything that comes with the paid version, it's all very useful for me. And what I'm doing is I'm re-editing past video material, music videos that I created, so... Yeah, you know, I think that DaVinci Resolve Studio Resolve, is enough software for me. And also, it's on version 18 now.
The interesting thing is that DaVinci Resolve belongs to Blackmagic. Blackmagic was an Australian company that started in the beginning of 2000, making some modules for the film industry, and they decided to corrupt the market. Literally corrupt the market. That means there were companies that were making money for years. Sony was with Sony Vegas program. They sold it to Magix. Germans, they did the wrong move, like the job. And Adobe was so rich, so wealthy, so grateful, and they decided they no longer, at the end of 2008, no longer they want to sell the paid version, which was at that time about $6,000-$7,000, you could have a paid version. They want to have now monthly charges, because monthly charges are good for them, and customers didn't have a choice. So Blackmagic literally corrupted the whole market, and not only the market for video editing, the market for the cameras. What happened is they put on the market very cheap camera, and that was a Blackmagic Pocket Cinema camera. That camera cost very little money, had very little future, but color was absolutely amazing. So that was actually what made the films. And it was competing with Panavision Panavision was traditionally used for by movie film studios. And then later on, started to collide with Sony, Panasonic, and Arri, which Arri actually, the camera could cost $150,000. And they put another camera. A few years later, there was like Magic Pocket Cinema camera 4K, which was $400. And at that time, the cheapest camera that you could make a film that is accepted by Netflix was $28,000. All of the companies started to lose money, and at that time, Blackmagic decided to buy DaVinci. There was a small company, and they, after they bought DaVinci, they bought modules. And that was Fairlight modules for the sound. Fairlight was the company who was making a very sophisticated sound systems, but mostly software sound systems. They could have 200 channels. Now you have everything. You can have unlimited number of channels for $299 in DaVinci Resolve Studio. Then, a few years later, Blackmagic decided they're going to put another camera, which is Ursa. The camera was priced for $2,000, where the similar comparable camera was about $50,000. And again, they start to sell it. They change it for Ursa, the better version, then from 4K to 8K, and from 8K to 12K. And that resolution, nobody could match them because nobody had such a camera. And then from 12,000 price for 12K, which is the camera that is nobody can make in the world, they dropped the price 50%. So now it's $5,000. $6,000. So they're corrupting. Now, Panasonic made good cameras, but they were forced to make a camera that is compatible with the price, and they put a EVA-1, which I purchased, which was $7,400. And Blackmagic, seeing that, decided to put another Blackmagic Pocket Cinema camera, 6K, where EVA-1 was 5.7K resolution. Again, and that was $2,500. So what they're doing is they're pushing all of the companies that are being used also by Hollywood studios, and accepted by Netflix, they're actually corrupting the market, and they're winning. And to exit.
KG2RY.
Yes, David recognized that. I just want to, Wesley, usually the term I've heard is disruptive technology, not corruptive, because corruptive kind of denotes that you're weakening or sickening something. Whereas disruptive technology is something that disrupts the status quo in the technology. But, David, you want to say something?
But I liked the outdated Final Cut Pro 7 for these old computers. Works at 1080p resolution. And I say that DaVinci is far better than Adobe Premiere Pro, which I used for a long time. Back to you.
Final Cut Pro is Apple. So if you don't have Apple computer, you cannot use it. And Final Cut Pro was like, if you want this and that and this, that you need Apple computer. While DaVinci works with all platforms, any platform, and has modules, which allows you a footage that you have on Final Cut Pro to use with DaVinci or from Premiere Adobe with DaVinci. So actually, right now, after 6 years of Blackmagic, DaVinci Resolve, about 73% of all of professionals switched into DaVinci Resolve. And to XGA.
Yeah, but the DaVinci is quite adequate for what I'm doing. So, you know, I find it very useful. I have a G4 in my closet, an Apple Mac G4 computer, which has Final Cut Pro 6. I would run it, maybe if I'm doing like a big project, it could be fun to go back to the old computer, KG2RY.
Okay, I think other people want to also participate. There's not much time left, so Dr. Roy, pick up.
Okay, this is AC2GS, reminding everyone not to quick key. If you quick key, then the guy who's the net control operator sits here and stares at a screen and isn't able to speak on his own net. So keep that in mind, fellas. I was trying to get across the idea that it's called disruptive technology, not corruptive, because if it was corruptive, it would kind of weaken and sicken things, whereas it disrupts the status quo of the technology. So I just wanted to put that term across.
Yeah, so in other words, we're talking about $150,000 camera not selling, and studios, professional studios quitting all expensive stuff, all of the modules, when a hard drive for RE camera is $2,500, just a hard drive. And you're paying this money just because it fits the slot. So there was the expo a month ago, and Ari was pushed to make the camera that is much cheaper, $78,000, but still too expensive. They also put another Ari Alexa, the camera that is about $6,000, but that camera doesn't have any modules into it, while Blackmagic cameras have everything included, including the NR filters. So what we're seeing is the whole industry that was for 60 years growing up and making big money and was only for few who were advanced and rich, now is available to everybody. And to XGA.
Yeah, but Wesley, the internet is mostly 1080p, 1080p, 720p. So since I'm working mostly to produce content for the internet, I don't need a 12K camera, and I don't need a brand new computer.
I do absolutely agree. I do. The only thing is that instead of paying for any software, you can have a free version, and you can have 1080p as well, and it's not a problem. So it's 1920 by 1080. It's not 744 by 1080. It's 1920 by 1080, so that's 1080p, and it's a quite nice resolution to work with. It's free. You can use it. You can play with it. It's just a great toy. And to XGA.
But Wesley, you realize that when you pay for the studio version of this software, you get like maybe two-thirds more effects and filters and stuff, and it's all very useful, and that was the part I was trying to get.
Yeah, well, the thing is that software doesn't have to be paid. the studio version, the paid version studio is being given for free if you buy anything from Blackmagic. So if you buy a Blackmagic Pocket Cinema Camera 4K for $1,200, you get a free version of the studio. I mean, for the studio version for free. And if you buy a special keyboard they make for editing, you're also getting it for free. I have practically all of it. It's a Blackmagic line. I have many panels for color editing. I have a keyboard, the first one, which was $1,000. They dropped the price to $600 for the keyboard, just a keyboard. Which is much less than the pool console, which is $29,999. Okay, and eBay, you can get for half of a price paid version because people don't know what to do with it. When they buy the equipment from Blackmagic, they give so many copies for free and they don't know what to do with that. So you can actually get the Blackmagic packet, program for half of a price, 50%, instead of $299. You're paying $150, and you have a full version. Now, the full version is good not only for the particular program, but for all of the future updates. So I bought 5 years ago, and I had the key for it, the hard copy key for it. Now they have it software key for it, and I can use it in any computer. I can take it to my pocket, and in a minute, loaded in every part of the world, and it's going to work. Enter XGN.
But Wesley, I don't need the camera. I don't need the keyboard. I need the software. Software works great for me, you know, making some kinds of abstract music videos. So what I'm doing really is taking the software and just messing everything up, and I really like it. And I want to thank you for turning me on to the software.
Thank you very much. I think we blab on it too long. Dr. Roy, pick up.
Okay. I'm glad that David listened to you and has a new program, and I hope he's able to do all kinds of interesting things now using DaVinci Resolve. Again, if anyone out there is interested, I would strongly recommend you download the free model and kick the tires and see if it's for you. And, you know, if you're not a professional, then most likely that'll be more than enough for most people. There is a stiff learning curve, so I wish you good luck, David, discovering all the nuances of this piece of software.
Thank you very much, Roy. I just want to say that I've tried a whole bunch of different video editing software packages. This one is extremely good for 4K. It's like a modern video editing software and a video editing suite. But the old Final Cut Pro 7, we learned how to use it in grad school in the film class. And, it was quite precise, and every little detail you had to know. But I think it's in DaVinci, you know, it's somehow incorporated in there in a different way.
But DaVinci works with any platform. You can have a Linux, Unix, Apple, Windows-based computer, any computers you want, and it works with it, and is also working with other programs. I was also using the Sony Vegas. I was using some other programs, and I found out that the money that they ask for just 1% of the option that Da Vinci has is more than you pay for entire software if you want to have a studio version. But you don't have to have a studio version. All of the things that you have in a studio works in a free version. The only one that doesn't work is few tricks and resolution. So in the free version, you have a 1080p resolution. You don't have a 4K.